Good afternoon. We will open up the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Today is Tuesday, May 14th. Appreciate everybody for being here. We are going to have a public hearing, but we'll have an informational meeting update on development of disaster debris management plan. And we will, I believe, start with our information hearing. Is that correct? Okay. And so with that, we'll bring up our first panel, if we will, and that'll be Brigadier General Mike Caldwell and Marty Plotner, Director of Office of Emergency Management. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to see you. And as always, thanks for coming to the Veterans Committee. I know it is, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Military Department, and we're delighted that the committee is headed down this path and taking a look at all aspects of what we do, and we think it's going to be beneficial and fruitful. I'm going to tee it up for Director Plotner and just basically just lead into the importance of all of the emergency management, particularly as we look at the threats, and I'm sure you're familiar with the resiliency report that was just delivered to the legislature. And I think this all ties in together. So with that, this is an important factor of that whole overall overarching plan. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Marty and let him walk you through what we do.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marty Plotner. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Management within the Oregon Military Department. The subject of debris removal, debris management, is almost as complicated as the subject of emergency management. What we have learned, Oregon is unique, and we have an annex that does cover debris management in a fundamental manner, but when you think of debris management, you mainly think of road openings and landslides and trying to make corridors or access ways. But what we've learned following the tsunami of Japan is that includes debris management for the ocean and for the causeways and for the other aspects of it, which we've been able to expand our planning sessions a great deal on. With the hiring of our public-private partners, we've also really put a lot of emphasis with the Corps of Engineers over the last 6 months in trying to do some outreach with those private corporations and getting them loaded onto the systems that allow them access as contractors at the last minute to do debris removal, since the government does not have the assets to do it on our own. In the other areas, you'll find on our website, hung is the annex to the state emergency operation plan that includes debris management and leaves a specific primary agency, both the Corps of Engineers and Department of Transportation, who are the lead agencies responsible for debris removal. I would be happy to answer any questions. We can go 100 different directions with this subject. And so to give you more of a broad overview on, yes, we do have a plan. Yes, it incorporates many aspects. We've incorporated both waterways as well as ground debris removal when the tsunami hit, and have expanded that into our state plan, and it's available for anyone to look at.
Might just, Mr. Chairman, add a couple of things. You recall the Vernonia floods that we had in Representative Witt's district a few years ago. One of the primary impediments to getting recovery started and getting it moving after that event was the debris. There was mountains of it. We've never really dealt with anything quite like that up to that point, 2007, I believe. Last time that had happened was in 1996 in Vernonia, and we'd kind of lost some of that artwork of how you deal with this. And again, as Marty indicated, we went to the private sector. We had ODOT, National Guard, and private sector, all three, in there working together to get that debris out of there, because it was everything from soup to nuts, mattresses, you name it. If it's in a household, it had to go away, and we had to find a place to put it because they had been inundated with 3 or 4 foot of water. So that was a good exercise for us. We learned a lot from that, and we've incorporated that into our current plans and how we go about it. So, and the last thing I'll say is that JTMD, the Japan tsunami debris situation that we're dealing with currently, marine debris on the Oregon coast. We all know about the dock, but there is tons of other debris coming in. We're seeing a lot more now with wood and other things. And so, again, it's an issue. The Parks has done a fabulous job, just a yeoman's job of making sure they've taken care of it with their rangers and with the public, non-governmental organizations that really do cherries and take care of the coast. So there's been a lot of free labor, if you will, helping in the situation, as was the case in Vernonia. But you still got to pay for somebody to come in and load the trucks, have the trucks, and then you got to find a place to put it. And that was real, initially was kind of a challenge in Vernonia. It's not so much of a challenge on the coast, except for the dock, which was a tremendous challenge.
Yeah.
And so there's only one more of those out there floating around, we think. So we'll just hope it goes someplace else.
Sure.
We're happy to answer any questions.
And that's part of the plan? Let's hope that someone will go somewhere else?
It's written in the annex.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
I feel pretty good about that plan.
JTMD, that was the Japan tsunami?
Correct.
Marine debris
Task Force, which I also had that, and it's a combination of different state agencies and other citizens and non-governmental organizations that have done a really good job of organizing that whole system.
I see my friend Googling tsunami to realize it does start with a T, so.
No wonder I couldn't find it.
So the private-public partnerships are obviously very important in terms of emergency management, in terms of disaster preparedness, and what we're going to do. How does this work with FEMA, and how's the model in terms of funding, and is there some interaction there? How does that work out?
In the area of debris removal, what the two initiatives FEMA is actually doing on that, which is, one, putting some thresholds on debris as far as costs, which help us go into that soft match. The other area that FEMA has done recently, which is in the past, they've allowed states to actually contract with the private sector to haul away debris. But what they did following Hurricane Sandy is they actually allowed salaries for state and county workers to be included in that debris, if that was their job function or if they were shifted to that function to include overtime, which really helped a lot of smaller organizations, particularly at the county and city level, who have utility jurisdictions that can do debris removal, and it allowed them to pay them first instead of having them stand by on the sideline while they wait for the bidding process to occur on the contracts.
Great. And is that paid back? Do you know, is that paid back on overtime rates also?
It's still the same threshold of 75% is covered from the federal government. 25% would still be covered by the incident.
Okay. Thank you.
Might just add one other thing to that discussion is that we last session the legislature authorized us to create a position. We're calling it the public-private partnership position, where we're developing. We've asked for this for several years. We never found it in our budget. The last session they did that. We hired that individual. He was just starting to work now, primarily with utilities, because we already had a structure built up there. But the idea is to reach out beyond that, to include exactly what Director Plotner said, is that we would have, in theory, and where we're headed is that you would actually have an on-call list. And so we would have qualified people literally throughout the state, but focusing primarily, in the areas that we are most concerned about, the coastal counties and into the Willamette Valley. And so we would have an on-call list that we could just immediately execute on that. And that would be part of this job, is to keep that up and keep it vibrant. So if the guy goes out of business, you're not calling an old one.
Sure.
And that sort of thing. So that's the direction we're going with that position. And he's a very busy man, but we're trying to get it all put together so we have it at our fingertips. Most of the counties already have that. And it's really pretty easy. They have it in their plan. They know their local governments. They know their local contractors. So it's really a matter of us just making sure that we can help them execute.
Yeah, excellent.
Chairman Matthews, if I could add to that, one of the keys in that outreach with the private sector is actually not getting them informed, but getting them to actually establish so they're a valid contractor prior to the incident.
Right.
Because by the time they go through that process following an incident, we'll be done.
Yeah.
And we won't be able to access them in time. So a lot of our outreach in conjunction with the Corps of Engineers and Department of Transportation is to do luncheons and get those organizations and associations that have businesses to get signed into the Oregon system early and do that now. This summer, in actually August, we're going to do a tabletop exercise with the engineer associations who have affiliation in law firms, architect firms, etc., to actually do that exact same thing, is to show them the time difference between trying to get established with that contract or if you had the contract prior to the incident.
Right. Now, as I say, failing to plan, or planning to fail is failing to plan, so good for you. Thanks for doing all the front-end work on this. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard about some of the obstacles to recovery. I will tell you that there was nothing that would stand in the way of recovery in Vernonia, Oregon, or Astoria, or any place else, with the National Guard and General Mike Caldwell on the scene. And it wasn't just the recovery. I mean, it was the rescue beforehand too. And I just like to relate one instance: the night of the flood. And we had there's a relatively small creek going down the side of the road just outside of the city limits. And what had been just this pastoral little creek, 1 hour, several hours later, is a raging torrent that was actually carrying vehicles down the water body. And we had one vehicle with people in it that got away. And these people were in grave danger of drowning. And as that vehicle was going down the water body, the Oregon National Guard lassoed the thing and reeled it into shore. And I will tell you that was a pretty amazing feat, pretty amazing. So.
And I'm just relieved to hear that these gas vehicles didn't somehow drift themselves into Waldo Lake from your location.
that's exactly right, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions of this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate that. And we have approximately 20 minutes allotted per panel, and we'll hear from our local governments next. And if we could please have Mr. David McCall from Solid Waste Coordinator with Tillamook County, and Dean Perez, the Emergency Management Director with Clatsop County. Gentlemen, if you will, and
Mr.
just need
Chairwell.
To state your name for the record, and you can begin in any fashion you will. We'll give Representative Boone a chance here.
Yeah, thank you. While you're setting up, I just want to welcome both of them are my constituents, so welcome. And I'm late today because I was over at OEM at a meeting for OSPAC, kind of wrapping up our work and starting the next phase, which we'll hear about in Senate Bill 33.
Well, I should explain. I mean, this is a great turnout for today, and thanks for being here. But we have our vice chair absent today and excused. But folks will be coming in and out of the room and off the dais because they have other bills in the Senate. And, of course, with the time constraints that we're under, we're trying to get bills moving in the Senate as well. So don't be surprised if the panel before you changes as we continue throughout the event. So, whichever one you'd like to start,
you're
feel
right.
Free for the record and provide us your name and testimony.
Since
thank
I'm
you.
Up, Chair Matthews and members of the committee, my name is David McCall, and I'm the Solid Waste Program Manager for Tillamook County. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to be here today and share some of our experiences and thoughts and concerns regarding disaster debris. As I'm sure you're all familiar, Tillamook County is a coastal county. This map is probably not the best map for all of our purposes, but what this map does do a pretty good job of doing is showing how many roads we have connecting us with the outside world, outside the county. The red ones are state highways. The black ones are county roads, which means if in the event of a major disaster, it's very likely that we will be cut off from the outside world. We may be able to get up and see our good friends up in Clatsop County, at least from the north part of Tillamook County. But also what you see on this, the green and the blue areas are forest lands. And because a lot of them lie around either the state the roads or other roads of which we may have, in a large enough storm, we basically accept the fact that we're probably going to be cut off. We will have very little opportunity to move in and out of the county, and we try to prepare for that. And as we all know, to the west, it would be a long swim to get to anybody else. When we look at disaster debris, we look at three different types of storms that we consider. One, we have a fairly decent experience with what we call regular disasters. These are local storms that come in, and if you look at this short list, we have at least one every year for the last 5, 6, 7 years. And these are the federally declared storms that we've had. These are wind and flooding caused disasters, and it's pretty easy to forget about them. Part of that because we've done a good job of preparing for these storms. But like I said, these are local smaller events, even though they're not all that small whatsoever. Here you can see a slide from 2007, a storm that came and literally just cut one of our roads in half. There was no access going over that road after that. Some of the challenges we have is that work needs to be commenced immediately, hopefully even completed immediately, to restore a certain sense of day-to-day life in the community. But a lot of times it takes longer than that to have that storm federally declared as a federally declared storm. And we also have funding issues. As all governments are experiencing these days, we're also looking at, in the list of storms that we had, back at the beginning of the list, we had twice as many people working in our county public works department as we do today. We're still dealing with the same type of storms, but with less people. And funding is not readily available, even in the event of a federally declared storm, as we heard from General Caldwell, 75%. That means the local government has to come up with the other 25% somehow. And these things cost money. Repairing a road like this is not a quick fix and not cheap either. No. Then we also have the type of storms which happened elsewhere, but the effects come later to us. And these are storms with their disaster debris. It's very difficult. They don't fit into the normal formula and the normal schema. These are pictures from tsunami debris coming in. Well, marine debris. Quite a bit of it tsunami, but not all of it tsunami related. Lots and lots of styrofoam along our coast, which we're continuing to pick up and take care of. We don't know how long we will still be picking this up and taking care of it. It's not all docks. It's a lot of little items day to day. It may last for another month. It may last for another 3 years. We don't know the extent of that. And it's, at best, we can only guess. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, it doesn't fit with the normal formula. An example with all the styrofoam that we have and we've been picking up, we applied for a federal grant for a so-called styrofoam densifier. We applied back in October. We have not yet heard whether or not we're going to receive the money for that grant. In the meantime, we've been collecting the styrofoam and just sending it off to the landfill because we have no other solution for it. These are just some thoughts of different types of disasters, but I think what we're really here to talk about is a large disaster. Tillamook County has a disaster debris management plan, which was adopted in 2007 and revised in 2008. It focuses on, mutual aid agreements that we have with the cities, with other counties, with other agencies. And we also have PPP contracts in place, mainly with local contractors and engineering consultants. As I mentioned, because of our geographical situation, it's very important that we're able to work with the locals because we have a set of known unknowns. We don't know how we will be cut off from other counties and for how long we will be cut off. Which roads and bridges will be even usable? I thought of that today driving down here to Salem. I think if we had a major disaster, we might be communicating over the phone, but I doubt we'd be communicating face-to-face because we wouldn't be able to come down 18, 6, 22, those roads would be cut off. Will our present agreements and the capacity suffice to take care of this? And also, how will other priorities come into play? If a disaster affects 500,000 people, what priority are we going to be given to come and help us out? How difficult is it to fix our roads vis-a-vis roads elsewhere in the state? And as I mentioned, this disaster debris plan was last updated in 2008. We have certain barriers with updating it now. We need to update it. Barriers include time. It's a time factor. Most of us are only given 24 hours a day. Some of us might have 26 hours, but still 24, 26 is a limit. There isn't much more time. Also, experience in education. In Tillamook County, two of the lead people for this plan are new to the county. We've been there less than a year. We don't know all the local circumstances and connections and possibilities. Also, land use questions, which I'm sure that DEQ will speak a little more about later. And as I mentioned before, funding. Funding is a very important factor in ongoing funding and in establishing our priorities as well. In summary, we have a proven ability to bounce back from these very harsh but local storms that we've been experiencing during the past years. We have extremely good volunteer and education networks operating throughout the county. I would welcome the possibility at a later time to bring in our Nehalem Bay Emergency Volunteer Corps chair or lead person. She's an incredible person who's done incredible things throughout the county, not only in the Nehalem Bay area. But at the end of the day, we are also struggling with daily challenges. Many times it's difficult to secure the proper amount of time and energy in updating a plan for something which we don't know if we will need it next week or next year or in 10 years, especially when you have day-to-day items hanging over your head. With that, I'm more than happy to take any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the information. What we might do is, do we want to have questions specific to Mr. McCullough now, or do we want to have perhaps the next next presentation, and we'll see what we have for the panel? That might be best.
Okay.
If we can do that, are you both loaded up to where you're using the same computer? And Michael, get you all set up there.
Chair Matthews, committee members, my name is Dean Perez. I'm the emergency manager for Clatsop County. And as David said, we work, we're a coastal county, and I didn't bring a map, so good job, David. You. David said, Clatsop and Tillamook counties, we pretty much experience the same weather events. We also are working closely with Oregon Emergency Management, the state parks, on the Joint Tsunami Task Force, which, by the way, is working extremely well. And talk about an opportunity to solve a problem quickly and bring people together. That's a great example of good leadership from OEM recognized the problem, brought the key players, DEQ, state parks, OEM, and the local emergency managers, and really got down to the brass tacks of how we're going to deal with it. So leading up to the next challenge here is how are we going to manage debris in a disaster? And as David said, we're pretty good, Clatsop County's pretty good about dealing with the windstorms that we get periodically, and I think we're in a competition for federally declared disasters. I think you're up to 13, we're up to 10, so we're definitely a record we're not trying to beat. But we in Clatsop County, every year we do face, we don't practice for it, we actually deal with it. So on my to-do list, or on the to-do list for Clatsop County, is to develop a debris management strategy. We've got a plan, but I can tell you that I don't look at it every day. I don't read it every day. But what we really need to do is move from the planning stage to the strategic, and that involves working with not just your locals, but developing those relationships with the state. As Mr. Chair, as Representative Witt talked about, the Vernonia experience in the National Guard. Those are relationships that you've got to continue to leverage, and as we do that, we'll start to see success. The other area is just organizing your debris teams. People turn over, new people come in, and so through your emergency management preparedness committees, you have that opportunity to bring these individuals and talk about the different planning phases of debris management, preparedness, you name it. One of the areas that we also need to focus on is ordinance and laws. What are we going to do with this stuff, and where are we going to put it, and making sure that you're still operating within the spirit of the ordinance and the laws. And then, of course, you've got to think about the cost recovery, and David talked about that there is a cost to handling, hauling, and removing this debris, and then beforehand developing those key partnerships, those MOUs and written documents with your local haulers. This is a picture of Vernonia, and even though it's in a different county, it's very likely that this could happen in Tillamook. It could happen in Clatsop counties just as easily. Planning considerations definitely are the health and safety issues, critical facilities and infrastructure, training. And, you know, what I've always learned is however you train is how you're going to respond. And so we need to make sure that we're training our first responders in the right and correct way, making sure that we have contracted services with your local or local haulers, and also have a plan B. If something happens to your local hauler, do you have a relationship with somebody outside the area that you can call in? Hazardous materials, if you look at this picture and you can see the water and everything that's mixed in, we need to make sure our plans address the hazardous material aspects. And then finally, how are you going to educate your public? I think in the 2007 windstorm, even though communications were difficult, those relations that we had with the local communities were able to get the word out to the locals where are they going to take their rotten food. And if you know Clatsop County and Tillamook, we, you know, it's not uncommon for a lot of the population to have two and three ice or freezers full of food, and we those are some of the issues we were dealing in addition to the woody debris. We also need to consider, instead of just hauling this stuff off to the landfill, I think we need to look at ways that we can reduce, reuse, and recycle, and not just haul this off. And it depends on the size of the disaster, but those are some planning considerations as well. Finally, questions that that we need to consider. Your critical facilities in your county, who are you going to coordinate with your debris response, how it's going to be collected, how are you going to deal with your hazardous household debris, environmental issues, pre-positioning or designating pre-positioned areas of where you're going to haul hazardous materials and non-hazardous materials. And then, of course, making sure that our plans are synced with the state. And I also, again, applaud General Caldwell and Director Plotner, who do reach out to the locals and assist us with our plans, because, as David is saying, we only, you know, have a certain amount of time that we can put these plans. And so we appreciate and hope that assistance continues to come from OEM. So in summary, this was more of an informational brief. I think that my message to you is that Clatsop County, I think we are definitely doing a good job in the preparedness side, but moving through the resiliency piece, we definitely need to improve and take advantage of opportunities to prepare for the recovery side. And so that's having conversations like this is excellent, because it brings it up to our attention, and we can leverage those relationships and share and educate each other. So with that, Chair Matthews, we're prepared to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Mr. McCall or Mr. Perez? Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So, you know, on the hazardous waste piece, obviously we're talking chemicals and things like that. What else do you kind of classify in that hazardous waste piece?
Well, you're exactly right. In Astoria, we have fish processing plants, and so there's chemicals that they used in the refrigeration piece, and through our local emergency planning committee, we work with the local fire chiefs to talk about, number one, identifying what kind of chemicals there are and what the local firefighting first responders can do to deal with these certain type of chemicals. The piece that we need to work out is what are we going to do with these chemicals once we've mitigated, what are we going to do with them, where are we going to take them? And that's a piece of the plan that we need to continue to develop.
Yes, follow up.
So I guess where my thought that is, you know, when you have for you know, the debris coming in, but if you had an environmental hazard, you know, something actually happened on our coast and there's this kind of debris left, I'm thinking, you know, a building that comes undone or whatever, old buildings that have asbestos and all of those kind of things. I mean, I'm assuming that's kind of in that thought process of what is considered hazardous.
That's right. Yeah, asbestos, household chemicals, and then chemicals that you might have in your fish processing plants as well.
What about like medical waste? If you had an issue with that, if you actually had a situation where...
Not yet. I know that there's been some concern with the cruise ships that are coming in, but not directly, no. I think the hospitals have a plan in place to deal with medical waste.
I see some folks nodding their head affirmatively, so we're going to go with that, and thanks for that. Representative Boone?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and maybe it'll help you guys, too, for your next phase. The resilience plan that's being rolled out will be meeting then jointly in this committee and the Senate committee for three times, and then the Transportation Committee for one time, discussing the recommendations that are in the plan and how they can fit together with what's happening locally. And we have a lot of, well, that's what I was doing before this meeting, kind of planning for that. And we have a lot of expectations that are not really unreasonable, because you're doing things locally. We've done something statewide, and putting it together is what we're talking about and how to keep that going. So we'll have those four meetings. And then during the interim, I hope to have committee hearing, informational hearings, too.
Absolutely. I think it's another one of the pieces that makes this bigger picture. But the resilience plan itself is lacking the prioritizations of different areas and where we want to go. And I think that's going to be a big part of why we're going to have meetings, but also why the interim work will be so important. So there is some work being done. And Representative Boone, you have always had an interest in it, and you will be heavily engaged, I know.
I hope so.
Yes, absolutely. You will be a part of that. Thank you.
The creek don't rise, but it will.
And if it does,
you've
got a plan.
I know.
Any other questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much, and thanks for keeping it within the timelines, too, and making the drive today. Thank you. Next up, we will hear from, that was from the coastal local governments, now from the Valley. John Vanderzanden, Emergency Program Manager for Marion County, and Kevin Vodrikasaus. I think that might be right, or at least close. Solid Waste and Recycling Senior Coordinator, City of Portland, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And if I have butchered your name, I apologize, sir.
Spot on.
Thank you. And again, in whatever order you like, we're keeping each panel to about 20 minutes, but see if we have questions when you're done. So, gentlemen, thank you.
I'll go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Vanderzanden. I have the privilege of being the emergency manager for Marion County. I would also like to introduce a gentleman back here, Mr. Roger Stevenson, who is the emergency manager for the city of Salem. And so we partner and team quite often as we move through a process of developing a plan for disaster response and debris management. I'd like to provide just a little bit of perspective here. This is a study that was done in 1999, and so the figures have been adjusted since 1999, but they're up about 30% from what they had originally seen. And this is for Marion County alone. Report a total of about 664,000 tons of debris generated during an 8.5 Cascadia earthquake. And that equates to about 2.9 million yards of debris that we would have to deal with. And in order to do that in just a single site alone, we would have to have something that are in the range of about 200 to 250 acres of ground in order to be able to process stuff effectively and make it less of a problem to the county. Now, I have 20 cities in my county. All of them we have relationships with. We have relationships with the haulers. We have quite a broad range of support in this process, but we still run into some pretty serious problems. And some of the other speakers had addressed the issue of acreage. Where are we going to find that kind of a resource that we can use to do this process? It's time consuming. It's going to last 2 to 3 years after the event takes place if we have a major significant event. And what do we do with the land if it belongs to a private land owner or even the state? What do we do with that land? Because it's most probably going to become basically a Superfund site that we clean up and bring back to its pre-disaster state of whatever it was used for. So those are a couple of the things that we face and dramatically that we're trying to deal with and help them get through that process with us. I had the distinction of being the emergency manager that had to work with the city of Almsville and as they did their response from the tornado. And it's impossible to understand the destructive power of that, even that small one that they had there. But the real saving grace to the whole thing for them was the community. And the community working together in order to be able to respond to it. If you want to see something amazing, just look at the number of chainsaws that come out of the woodwork when we have a disaster of that nature, and people just coming out wanting to help, wanting to support their local neighborhood. It took them about 2.5 days to clean up after that storm, and there was significant tonnage that was available then. Fortunately, the local haulers came in with their drop boxes, left about 8 or 10 of them sitting around the city in strategic places, and people brought their stuff to the big boxes and they hauled it away. That was a fairly easy response. The long-term recovery from a major event is going to be significantly more than that. And unfortunately, when we're dealing with cost recovery from FEMA, which is part of that recovery phase that we keep talking about, we plan for the response phase, but the response phase actually starts about 6 hours after the recovery phase actually starts about 6 hours after the event takes place. And so we're into it early and we're out of it late because it's going to take a long time to be able to mitigate our way through it. So the bottom line is it's teamwork, it's planning way far ahead. It's getting to know the people you're working with and taking their interests and their resources that they can support us with and trying to put that plan together. So it's actually been a pleasure working with it. And I would like to thank OEM for providing us the access to the state Homeland Security grant dollars that we got in order to do our plan back in 2008, as well as the other 5 counties in our emergency management region. We got it paid for, and they helped us write a pretty good plan to help us, at least in the initial response process. So,
great.
Any questions of me?
Any questions? Sir?
Chair Matthews, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Vodrikasaus, and I am the Solid Waste and Recycling Senior Coordinator for the City of Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. My work has included managing a regional disaster debris planning project that was funded by a Department of Homeland Security grant, and we're now preparing to manage a follow-up project from another grant that we've received from the same source. I'm also the chair of the Regional Disaster Debris Management Planning Update Task Force. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today. So for the City of Portland, it's absolutely critical that our planning is done collaboratively with the other jurisdictions in our region. While individual jurisdictions will develop their own plans that are specific to their unique needs, resources, and capabilities, we must also have the ability to communicate and coordinate our disaster debris management efforts on a regional scale during an actual event. And the Portland metropolitan area is also unique because of the metro regional government, which has solid waste planning responsibilities as well as authority for the waste and disposal facilities within the 3-county area of Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County. So currently, the City of Portland's Bureau of Emergency Management is developing a disaster debris management plan. And the purpose of this plan is to prepare the city to remove, reduce, recycle, and dispose of the disaster debris in order to reduce the threats to human health and safety and harm to the environment after a catastrophic event. All of this is being done with the goal of ensuring regional cooperation and a shared recovery, including a shared economic recovery from the event. So Portland faces some unique challenges, and they're often because of the sheer size and population density that we have in our city. And some of these issues that are particularly difficult to address in creating our plan include the fact that the responsibilities and resources are often spread amongst multiple bureaus within the city, including some that are not always thought of right away when talking about emergency response. So, for example, besides emergency management and transportation, we also have development services, planning and sustainability, Parks, Office of Management and Finance. All of these must come together both in the planning phase as well as during the response and recovery. Also, the amounts and types of debris that would result will vary significantly depending on the type of event and the time of year that it occurs. Separating the different debris types and disposing of them correctly is absolutely essential for, among other reasons, to maximize the FEMA reimbursement that we receive. So some types of material that we're pretty certain that we'll have to deal with and that will present collection and handling challenges for us are, for example, woody debris. And this is something that we're all more used to. It reduces in size pretty well, and we're pretty good at keeping it out of the landfills. But then there's also the construction and demolition debris and rubble. This is very heavy. It's difficult to move. And from the building debris, we have to worry about things like asbestos, which are not necessarily apparent up front, but can have very long-term, long-lasting effects on the community. The white goods and appliances present another problem. Just for as an example, refrigerators must be disassembled by a certified technician in order for their handling to be reimbursable by FEMA. Also, silt and sediment resulting from landslides. The volume of that would vary greatly depending on the type of event and the season that it occurs. And there'll be much more of it if it's during the wet season, which in the Portland region is most of the year. But it's also very difficult to move around and to collect and to separate. So the point is you can't simply pick up the debris, drop it in a truck, and ship it out somewhere. It has to be thoughtfully managed and processed beforehand and then sent to the right place at the end. So while addressing some of these issues, we are also finding opportunities to collaborate regionally. And it's very important to have these conversations and to develop these relationships during the planning phase rather than in the midst of responding to the event itself. One of the biggest challenges is identifying the sites that will be used for the temporary storage and reduction of the material. There's very little open space that's of suitable size and conditions within the city limits, so we're going to be very dependent on our neighbors for this. Also, there are multiple stakeholders that have roles in the siting and operating of these facilities. For example, DEQ, who we'll hear from shortly, is responsible for a lot of the permitting. But the Metro Regional Government is responsible for operating these sites, as well as tracking the material as it comes in and out of the facilities. So just deciding where to place them is a challenge. They have to be near major transportation corridors. They have to be very large. Ideally, they should be paved. Most sites like this are in high demand, both up front before the event and certainly during the event, by a number of other folks wishing to use them for their response and recovery activities. So they're very hard to find. But the good news is they're usually large enough that they can support the work of multiple jurisdictions. So when we find these sites, we can share them. And that's another example of how we're all mutually dependent upon each other. So the key point is to get it right the first time, because cities are not going to be eligible for the federal reimbursement if the material is moved more than once. And that's a key point, too. You can't just get it out of the way, take it somewhere, hoping that you'll find a better place later on, and wind up getting stuck footing the bill. So another lesson that we've learned within the city is that we have several bureaus that already have their own emergency management plans, and their work provides a lot of opportunities for cooperation and efficiencies throughout the region. Portland Bureau of Transportation has crews that are already pre-equipped and pre-trained. If a disaster were to occur, they would automatically self-deploy, go out, start clearing the critical transportation routes and inspecting bridges and overpasses. And by sharing this information that they find with ODOT and others, they can provide those folks with very valuable information and avoid a duplication of efforts. And this is going to be especially helpful for the first responders to navigate throughout the region. And another reason for collaborating on this sort of work is that as we're clearing our emergency transportation routes, we want to make sure that the neighboring districts are clearing transportation routes that will connect. So the timeline for this project is accelerated. We're in full swing right now. There's a lot of work going on. We'll have a draft plan by the end of this summer, and then we're going to test it in a tabletop exercise that includes some of our regional partners. We'll take the lessons that we learned from that plan and amend it as necessary, and then have a completed plan by the end of the year. But it is important to note that a completed plan does not mean that you're done with it, because regular and ongoing reexamination, continuing exercising, and updating of the plan to keep it relevant is a task that never ends. On a regional level, the city has participated in several regional disaster debris plans for over a decade. And again, this work has accelerated over the last few years. In 2008, Metro hired a contractor to develop components of an operational plan for managing the disaster debris sites within their jurisdiction. This is an important step in helping them prepare for their role in overseeing the management of these sites. More recently, in 2010, the City of Portland managed a project that was funded by the Department of Homeland Security. And this included the Metro Three-County region, but it also added Columbia County in Oregon and Clark County in Washington. It included several local jurisdictions and other agencies and special purpose districts across the region. We convened several stakeholder information and planning sessions that were attended by over 110 technical experts. And these were folks from all over the region, and perhaps more importantly, from a number of different disciplines who had not previously collaborated on disaster debris planning. So largely because of the success of this project, we've recently been awarded another grant by the Department of Homeland Security. And we're currently in the process of hiring a contractor and expect to begin work on this project by the end of this month. And this project is going to follow many of the recommendations that were identified in the last phase and will lead to the development of a regional disaster debris planning framework. And the framework is going to be a set of specific guidelines and critical components that individual jurisdictions can use in creating their own plans. So some of the lessons that we've learned regionally, maybe foremost, is that a lot of this progress is really only possible by physically bringing the people together in one place. There are a lot of stakeholders out there that have an interest in this, and some of them are not readily apparent. And that's both on the private and the public sector, as well as departments within the individual jurisdiction. And on the private sector, the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association will definitely have a role. We'll hear from them in a little bit, I think. Each jurisdiction needs to consider their own specific circumstances. We can learn from each other, but we can't just take somebody else's plan and fill in the blanks for ourselves. In the end, nothing replaces developing the personal lines of communication, just knowing who to call at different places. Since the stakeholder meetings, we've continued our information sharing, we've coordinated training efforts, and we have a lot greater overall familiarity with each other and with the capabilities across the region. Moving into the future, this ad hoc group of stakeholders is evolved into something that's more structured and permanent. We have continued our meetings, and we're going to continue to do so even after the grant money has gone away. Our group has become a task force within the Regional Disaster Preparedness Organization, which is a partnership of governmental agencies, non-governmental organizations, and private sector stakeholders within the Portland metropolitan region that's collaborating to increase the region's resiliency to disasters that was formed in 2012. Our task force was established to continue this disaster debris planning on a regional level, to share resources and opportunities to participate in exercises. So our region has made a lot of progress in its ability to respond to catastrophic debris-generating events. The City of Portland and the surrounding metropolitan region have benefited greatly by collaborating now during the initial planning phase. While each jurisdiction and region throughout the state has their own circumstances and are at risk for different types of events, many of the lessons that we've learned through our cooperative planning can be shared in other parts of the state through similar processes. And in the end, that's going to benefit Oregon as a whole.
So. Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. You said if you move debris more than once, you don't get paid for it. Why would it matter?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, it's a FEMA regulation. You can move it once to a temporary site. From there, it needs to be sent to the location of its final disposition. If it's moved to another temporary site, then that work is not reimbursable.
My next question is,
No, go ahead.
How would they ever know?
They know.
They're the government.
Big brother.
But when they're money involved and they're tracking these things, they are tracking it very closely. And there have to be receipts and documentation for every truck that comes in and leaves and exactly what it brought in and what it delivered and when and where.
The Google Earth car.
Yes.
Thank you for that. But so you can, but in a sense, you can move it twice. You can move it initially to a temporary, then you can move it to your permanent.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
But you just can't move it temporary to temporary, then another.
You can't move it three times.
Understood.
Three times you're out.
Understood. Yes. That's odd. Any other questions from the committee? So you had mentioned, Mr. Van Der Zanden, about how many chainsaws come out there, and it just got me thinking, if you were to put an all call out for help, you know, the roads are blocked, there's debris everywhere, and all of a sudden you have all these citizens that mean well, and we know that our communities are full of them, and that's great. If they're acting on a plea, you know, on your case, and somebody gets injured with a chainsaw, how does that work in terms of liability? Can you address that? If it's brief, that's great. If it takes more than that, we can talk offline. I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, there really is no way, obviously, to keep track of all the folks that want to come out and help. I mean, it's virtually impossible. However, we have put together processes through an emergency volunteer coordination center that we've had some help from hands-on, a local organization that helps with volunteers that want to get registered to come in and assist. Okay. If we take registered volunteers and we invite them to come and participate as part of the response to the event, then we can cover them under our county's liability insurance. If they're there just because they want to come and help and they haven't registered in, they haven't signed in, obviously we can't be held accountable for those.
I appreciate that. I've been working on for several years the search and rescue aspect of it. Yes. And I know that if somebody self-deploys on their own, there's no way for you to know that. But if they're deploying as part of a unit that falls under your guidance, then certainly there's a way to provide the workers' comp and liability there. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
So that's consistent. I appreciate that. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you both very much. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you. Look forward to working with you through the resilience plan, too. Thank you. And do you want to bring them together?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So the next panel, we will have from DEQ, Audrey O'Brien. She's Solid Waste Management and Disaster Debris Management in the Northwest Region. And for DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. And Laura Liebrick, Governmental Affairs Director with Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it very much. And identify yourselves for the record and start whatever order you'd like, but we appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Chair Matthews, representatives, I'm Audrey O'Brien with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I am a manager responsible for solid and hazardous waste oversight over the six northwest counties of Oregon. And I may be able to help answer a couple of the questions that came up earlier as I go through my presentation. So let me know if I don't cover some of them.
Let's
see. Whoops. As you might expect, DEQ's perspective in looking at managing disaster-related debris is focused on, regardless of the type of disaster, whether it was the 2007 flood in Columbia County or a tsunami or earthquake or a fire, DEQ's focus is going to be on what are the environmental concerns associated with the disaster, how is that reflected in the debris that's created, and how can DEQ help an incident response team manage the environmental impacts and prevent additional impacts from how debris is handled. And then also DEQ wants to be able to help with the communication and the outreach. So how can we let those first responders know what hazards they may face so they can take care of themselves in reaching out and helping respond to a disaster? DEQ's role is to focus on how can we help the incident command system function? How can we help an incident command team respond to a disaster? How can we help the local governments manage the debris that's created in a disaster? And how can we make sure there's no additional impacts to human health and the environment from how debris is managed and transported and disposed of? if requested, DEQ can work with a local government up front to pre-approve temporary sites that might be used for disaster debris-related storage, management, recycling, recovery, and then ultimate disposal. From my perspective as a solid waste manager, DEQ solid waste staff will help do a couple of things. We can help assess the status of the solid waste disposal system. How badly was it impacted from the disaster? Are there existing permitted sites that can still function and take disaster debris? Are there permitted sites that could be have their permits modified so they could take disaster debris? And if there aren't, how can we work with the local governments to get a temporary site permitted so that they can meet their FEMA obligations as well as manage debris in a way that doesn't cause further impacts to the environment? We also want to make sure that we can help communicate with the public, with the local government. So if someone's systems, they only have cell phones, can we put information on our website? Can we put out news releases? Can we put out information that people can use to assess whether it's safe for them to pick up debris that they might find in their yard? And how can we help them make sure they don't expose themselves additionally to an environmental concern? We can also provide technical assistance to local governments, to the solid waste disposal facilities, to the public. I've put a link to our webpage where we have posted information. We have fact sheets for people. We have fact sheets for local governments. We have a guidebook that we made available that can help a local government in terms of thinking about the plans. I really appreciated hearing from Mr. Perez some of the questions that he is trying to answer as he goes through and updates his plans, because some of those questions are directly related to things that DEQ wants to make sure happen as well. So some of the hazards that we would look for in the debris would include asbestos-containing materials. Our people, were their household cleaning products damaged in a flood? So it's now become household waste. So things like bleach and other paint, other types of chemicals that you might find in homes, how are they now damaged and are they going to need to be disposed of? Is there radioactive waste that's involved? One of the tabletop exercises I participated in, radioactive waste was the result. So we would, at DEQ, we would work with the Oregon Health Administration to identify temporary sites where radioactive waste could be taken so that people aren't exposed to it. Are there other wastes that have been created that might cause harms to the rescuers and to the workers trying to clean up from the debris, from the disaster? And is there potential for, as the incident command system is responding, for that waste to be moved and then cause further environmental impacts, and how can we help avoid that? So that assessment phase is something that DEQ can help with. And then after assessing the system that's in the solid waste disposal system, are there things we can do on top of that? So if there aren't, if the current system isn't functioning, can we permit temporary sites? And can we work with the local governments or the owner of a temporary site to identify what would need to happen for it to get a short-term permit that could then be used to make sure to meet all the FEMA requirements as well as prevent environmental impacts and get the site set up so that debris can be brought there? Is the site big enough? Can recycling happen at the site? Is there security associated with the site? And how can we make sure the site's restored after the disaster has been handled? In some cases, our permitting process requires that we get a land use compatibility statement for the local government that the site meets the land use requirements for having a disposal site placed there. So in some cases, during response to an emergency, the governor can issue an executive order that would waive that requirement. The governor can also include in that executive order a waivement of public notice and fees. And that's what actually did happen with the 2007 response to the flood in Columbia County. In addition, DEQ can work and provide technical assistance to local governments up front before we get into a disaster situation, so we can help make sure that we can provide or set up some of the permits that would meet the FEMA requirements. One question I heard earlier was, how does FEMA know? In some of the immediate response to a disaster, a FEMA representative often comes out on site and is available to help answer questions immediately. So they may not know all of the details, but they're going to know a lot of the details about what's happening in the response, because in many cases, the incident command team is working very closely with FEMA to make sure that the actions taken will qualify for reimbursement. In addition to siting a temporary disposal site, DEQ will work with the owner and the haulers and the local governments to make sure that all the operations that happen there are done in a way that makes sure these types of questions are addressed. I very much appreciated hearing about the idea of trying to recover and recycle many of the wastes that are created in a disaster situation, and that's what actually DEQ would look at also. We would try very hard to avoid burning any of the waste materials, as happened in 1996 and missed. So, as I said a little bit earlier, one of the roles that DEQ can play is really helping with the communication and the outreach. While we're not very good at Twitter and at social media sites right now, we have the ability to do broadcast emails, to put out press releases, to put information on our websites, to try to stay in contact with the haulers and the disposal sites and help make sure that information's transferred and in a way that helps make sure there aren't any additional environmental impacts from how debris is managed. So just to summarize, our priorities again are to assess what the environmental concerns are, make sure we can use existing sites or permit sites to help deal with debris, see what kind of debris can be recycled or recovered, can we avoid putting it into a landfill, how can DEQ help with communication and outreach, and how can we make sure that any temporary sites are closed appropriately so there aren't residual environmental issues. And so with that, I'll stop and ask if you have any questions for me.
I think we'll take them as a committee for the panel, so we'll hear from her next. Thank you, and thanks for your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, and staff. For the record, my name is Laura Liebrich, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuge and Recycling Association. I much appreciate the opportunity to be here today and in the company of such distinguished fellow panelists to discuss the solid waste industry's role in disaster debris management. ORA is the statewide trade association representing solid waste management companies in Oregon. ORA members collect and process most of Oregon's residential and commercial refuse and recyclables, as well as operate material recovery facilities, compost facilities, and many of Oregon's municipal solid waste landfills and transfer stations. ORA members are heavily regulated, beginning at the federal level with the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the enforcement of which is overseen at the state level by the Department of Environmental Quality. In most communities across the state, ORA members do their work under the direction of and in partnership with local city and county government. It's through these local jurisdictional relationships that our members have a role in disaster debris management planning, coordination, and implementation. It is our goal to be a resource and an advisor in the planning stage, a partner in coordination, and on the front lines when it comes to implementation in the aftermath of a disaster. The panelists who came before me did an outstanding job of explaining what is involved in developing a disaster debris management plan and demonstrating the need to have them in place. I hope to give you a more limited, on-the-ground perspective, sharing the experiences of one of our member companies, Western Oregon Waste, which operates in Tillamook and Clatsop counties, in the immediate aftermath of the Great Coastal Gale of December 2007, which also generated the flooding inland in Vernonia, same storm system. Their job was to help local jurisdictions to coordinate the management of disaster debris in the absence of a formal disaster debris management plan. At the time of the storm event, I worked for Western Oregon Waste, and my hope is to give you a feel for the kinds of challenges we faced in the first 3 days following the storm. I should start with the fact that in 2006, after having seen the grisly debris aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, I came to Salem to meet with Ken Murphy at the Office of Emergency Management to ask for his thoughts on how those of us in the solid waste industry could be of most help to local government in planning for disaster debris response. The director gave me the names of local emergency management people to speak with at the county level, and I was told that both Clatsop and Tillamook counties were working on plans at the time. I contacted the point people in both counties shortly thereafter, and they were happy to share where they were at in their planning process, though they admitted that neither of them had begun drafting the disaster debris management portion of the plan. I was happy to hear that there were plans in process and offered to be of assistance when it came time to work on the disaster debris segment. This was in mid-2007. On Wednesday, November 28th, 2007, I arrived at our offices in Warrenton to find a fax from the City of Astoria's Public Works Department in my mailbox. It was a copy of the National Weather Service bulletin alerting North Coast residents that there was a high wind advisory in effect beginning early morning on Sunday, December 2nd, ending on Monday night. Nasty weather is fairly common in late fall and winter at the coast, but in my 10 years there, I'd never received this kind of direct communication from one of the cities that we provided service to, so I read the entire page and I read it carefully. Noticed halfway through the report that there was a partial sentence boldly underlined in handwriting. The public works director had actually underlined it, that said, hurricane force winds are possible during second system. Sustained winds possibly upwards of 70 miles per hour with gusts exceeding 90 miles per hour possible in the headlands. I got on the NOAA weather website and kept checking for updates for the next 24 hours and passed the information I'd obtained along to our operations managers and supervisors. On Friday afternoon, we advised all employees to check in with their supervisors early Monday morning by phone or text if there were mass power outages over the weekend or if the wind speeds were in excess of 55 miles an hour. We would delay the start of operations if necessary. On December 2nd and 3rd, the North Coast was pummeled by what meteorologists called a mega storm, for lack of a better term, I guess. It was the result of multiple systems converging over the Pacific. For 36 hours, heavy rain and ferocious sustained winds exceeding 90 miles per hour mowed down, tore up, and generally thrashed trees, power poles, buildings, road signs, and houses. Pieces of windows, siding, doors, roofs, fences, barns, and garages were torn off and became destructive projectiles, scattering debris along the coastal corridor of Clatsop County. The most powerful gust was clocked at 147 miles per hour at the peak of the storm. It was impressive. I live on the south slope, facing south in Astoria, and that wind speed was clocked over Young's Bay, which is just south of where my house is. Caused extensive flooding further inland, as you've heard from some of the earlier panelists. The storm left coastal residents without power for nearly a week in most areas, close to 2 weeks in some areas, and without phone service for days. Landlines and 911 service went down on the first day of the storm on Sunday evening, and cell phone service terminated shortly thereafter. Many areas had no water. People could not use their toilets due to pump station failures. Highways 30, 26, and 101 were all closed simultaneously for a couple of days. We were effectively cut off. We're used to foul weather, but this is something entirely different, and it left a unique mess in its wake. On a personal note, as I said, I live high up on the south-facing slope in Astoria. The storm was coming from nearly due south when the second system hit very late Sunday night. I'd been on the phone, texting, with our operations and human resources managers based at our offices in McMinnville in an attempt to keep them informed about how bad things had become. I lost cell service at 12:04 a.m., and the last message I received was a text message saying, "You still there?" I was in my house watching debris come up the hill from the south, watching chunks of roofing and fences and trees blow into my neighbor's windows, seeing power poles literally snap like toothpicks halfway up. No one slept that night, and at 6 a.m. Monday, the storm was still raging to the extent that it was far too dangerous to even go outside. I had no way to leave my neighborhood and was hoping that our employees were wise enough to not attempt to leave their homes either. There were power lines whipping around and debris still flying everywhere, and wind gusts were still upwards of 75 miles an hour in the north part of the county. By noon, I got suited up in storm gear and began making the rounds to check on immediate neighbors. Everyone was in shock at the severity and really the longevity of the storm. It was truly ferocious for a good 36 hours. By Monday night, people were coming out of their houses and began to survey the damage after having been shut in for a day and a half. Everyone was talking about what a local radio station, and it was the only one operating at that point on generator power, was saying about the damage countywide. I had no way to reach any of my coworkers to find out what the plan would be on Tuesday morning, but I heard a bulletin on the radio, on my little emergency battery-powered radio, saying that the Clatsop County Emergency Operations Center was activated and that there would be a meeting for EOC members on Tuesday morning at the sheriff's office. When the storm subsided, the main roads began opening up on Tuesday, and Western Oregon Waste got down to the business of getting route and transfer operations up and running again, and working with local public agencies on an emergency debris management plan as none of them had formal plans in place prior to the storm. Our operational staff was out checking road conditions early Tuesday morning as soon as there was daylight. They traveled in teams of two for safety reasons and reported back on access to different parts of Clatsop County. There was still no road open to Tillamook County, so we couldn't hope to get our trucks down there to service that day. We had to determine how to get enough fuel to keep the trucks on the road since the local fueling stations were not operational. While operations was figuring out the service schedule, I headed to the EOC meeting to see if I could find out what was happening in other parts of the county that we didn't have access to yet. When I arrived at the EOC meeting, I checked in at the front desk and introduced myself as being from Western Oregon Waste, and I was told that public works people from the county and the city of Astoria had been hoping to reach us. They asked me to please attend their morning EOC meetings and help them figure out what to do with all the debris. They also asked if I would take disaster debris-related information to the local radio station, still running on generator power, twice a day, since I reported that I was already giving updates via radio on Western Oregon Waste collection operations and transfer station status. Tuesday afternoon, I drove to all of the cities in coastal Clatsop County except Cannon Beach, which was inaccessible until Wednesday, to talk with city personnel, mainly in public works, about what we could do to help immediately. I recommended, after initially discussing it with our operations team, that we set up debris management depots in each city with containers and drop boxes for the collection of woody debris, construction and demolition debris, and spoiled food. I then took the information of the radio stations and did live public service announcements telling the public where to find these depots and what was acceptable material. We were working on lining up a contractor to bring a mobile grinder to our transfer station in Astoria to immediately begin processing the woody storm debris flowing through the gates in drop boxes, pickups, and dump trucks. By day three, we were taking in over 1,500 to 2,000 cubic yards a day of woody debris alone. The majority of it was only from within the city limits of Astoria. Each community established its own storm debris drop-off depot. The cities of Gearhart and Seaside dedicated additional space for woody debris and hired contractors to come in and grind and load off on-site. Also on day three, we identified large volume generating customers, primarily hospitals and large grocery stores, who normally keep their garbage in large compactors, which require power to operate. They needed alternative ways of storing their waste. They had no power and had lots of putrescible waste heaping up and were in need of debris boxes, which would need to be serviced frequently. I visited all of these locations to help them determine where to stage the debris boxes and containers, and we arranged to have our roll-off drivers check in with them twice daily to see if they needed to be hauled. The safety and comfort of our employees were the primary immediate concerns. Operational managers and supervisors visited all accessible areas to assess which areas we could safely send our drivers into during the first week after the storm. We also tried to be sensitive to keeping our trucks away from the repair work being conducted by the 900 power trucks and crews who had shown up while the storm was still raging from all over the western United States. Many of our employees suffered damage to their own homes, but they came to work anyhow. It was impressive. Communication was problematic on a number of fronts. We couldn't communicate with one another by phone while out in the field for the first couple of days, or with our main office in McMinnville, or our customer service department, nor between drivers, dispatchers, and mechanics. For the first 2 days, in-person communication through attending the EOC meetings, doing radio station broadcasts, and driving to all jurisdictions in person daily to meet with city and county staff were the only way to get anything done during the initial couple of days. It took 3 days for the fueling stations to become fully operational. Fortunately, our policy always had been to fuel all of the route trucks at the end of their routes. So on Friday afternoon, when they were done with their routes, they had completely fueled the fleet. So we were able to use those trucks that were already fueled on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday before we were looking at running down to critical minimum. We were able to keep up on what areas were opening up in the first few days via the EOC and later through direct communication by cell phone from public works people in each city. We had no power at our facilities in Warrenton and Astoria. We had one small generator at each location. Even once the phone service was restored, we had no power to run our phone system nor our computers. All record keeping had to be done by hand and routes run from memory. Increased demand on labor and equipment and the need for additional drop boxes, debris boxes. Managers, supervisors, and drivers came over from our McMinnville operations to help out our coast crew. They brought supplies for all of the coast employees, food, extra clothing, batteries, ice, the kinds of things that they'd run out of long before that in the grocery stores. With the additional labor, we were able to extend our operating hours at our transfer station and put two people out in each route truck for safety purposes because there were so many road and overhead hazards. Many of our fellow garbage companies inland offered to loan us boxes, even equipment and drivers, to meet the needs of the increase in debris we needed to handle. Our friends at Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association served as a central point of communication for us, linking us up with the network of other haulers around the state. There's a staggering amount of woody debris, as you heard earlier, and literally tons of rapidly spoiling food, as well as a significant amount of construction and demolition debris, unsorted, which can be problematic for some of the reasons earlier illustrated, contains asbestos, lead, sometimes there's household hazardous waste mixed in with it. We didn't normally handle entire trees and huge stumps and limbs, but we were asked to find a means of managing it, so we did. DEQ offered us guidance and assistance during the first few days, and in fact, when I first got cell phone service back, the first phone call I got was from DEQ asking what they could do to help and what things looked like on the ground. So what did we learn? Two biggest takeaways from the experience boil down to these two simple things: be prepared and get involved. In many ways, we realized we were very fortunate with this event. We knew it was coming and had some time to prepare. Though the storm generated a lot of debris, it could be managed in a reasonable amount of time with existing equipment. And most importantly, we could get to it. We had access to it. Transportation infrastructure was only briefly compromised, and we had access to fuel relatively quickly. It was a wake-up call, though, and made us think about the kinds of disasters that can occur with little or no warning. We realized that we needed to have a plan to better take care of our people and our assets, first and foremost, in order to be of any use to our communities in the recovery phase. And we needed to be engaged with and committed to assisting our communities in developing comprehensive emergency management plans, including disaster debris plans. In the end, Western Oregon Waste was formally recognized by the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners for their hard work, cooperation, and good nature during challenging conditions, and for service above and beyond the call of duty. The mayor of Astoria came to the company's annual holiday party to present us with an award, thanking us for the instrumental role our employees played in response to the storm. The Cannon Beach Chamber of Commerce had pizza delivered to our drivers in thanks for their efforts, and I received calls from county and city council people, business owners, and residents, all heaping praise on our employees for the job they did after the storm, cleaning up the mess when it seemed to be so overwhelming. It was our pleasure to do so. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide testimony today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Quite a story from your experience. You know, you've not only helped with the company, but you're living it firsthand. Good for you. I'm glad to see you made it out of that.
Yeah.
Any questions of the panel? Yes.
No questions, really, just a comment. Laura's also a constituent of mine part-time. Mm-hmm. She lives in Astoria when she's not here working the session. But, yeah, you brought back some memories of that time frame, and I was stuck in my home. I think that was lucky for me in that sense because so many people were somewhere else when it happened, and they couldn't get home because, as you said, the highways were impassable with trees down. And it looked just like Mount St. Helens in some of the areas where they were down, just jackstraws down.
Yeah,
the good news was we were able to utilize the wood, though, at a point. So.
That's great. And it's hard for those of us that aren't in that setting to really grasp the magnitude of what you're experiencing. Thank goodness for the news media that can stand in the middle of it and tell us there's a storm. But I appreciate that very much. Any other questions from the committee? And yes?
Mr. Chair, I just have to respond. I used to have one of those radio stations that was the lifeline, giving directions to people. We weren't just saying there was a storm. We were communicating with the Lauras of the world and the General Caldwells, telling the people out on Mill Creek and up on...
Mm-hmm. It's part of the critical public-private partnership.
Absolutely.
I get it. I'm talking more about the reporter on scene. It tells you're you the right. Wind is blowing when they're standing sideways in the middle of a flood. Only hoping the fire can respond to, you know, save them.
I just wanted to also reiterate something that both of you had mentioned, but Laura mentioned it again. When the phones are out, the cell phones are out, The ham radio folks were the heroes. Yeah. And as a result of that, I think there have been hundreds of people. I mean, I'm not exaggerating, but and even Betsy Johnson, Senator Johnson, sat still for 2 solid days taking that class, if you can imagine that. And she has her ham license and radio, and she's ready to go. But so many people got their ham capabilities. And I think that's the real saving grace in a lot of these disasters. Because you could have, if you'd had that, maybe talked to your people. And, you know, we could thank everybody forever. I can't not thank General Caldwell and his gang of saviors and angels who just swooped down and saved the day, seriously, so many times in these storms.
Well, I think sometimes that's the issue, is getting people to realize that a disaster doesn't have to be a major flood. It doesn't have to be an earthquake. It can be a number of things, and it can impact your community. And so getting people prepared is really why it's so important with moving forward in terms of resilience plan and what we're going to be looking at. It's getting people to understand that you don't have to live on the coast to experience something in some sort of a natural disaster. It could be just about anything. So I appreciate you being here today, and appreciate everybody for being here today. And Ms. Edwards, outstanding job of coordinating the panels and keeping us on time. Thank you.
Public-private partnership.
Yes. That's how we make it work. Well,
thank you very much.
Yes, absolutely. Have a great day. Yeah. Thank you. And with that, we will close our informational meeting. And I believe, I don't see Representative Reed here yet, so would it be okay to open a work session on Senate Bill 598 as amended? And so we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 598 as amended. Ms. Edwards, if you could refresh our memory, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 598, as amended, has a minimal revenue impact and a indeterminate fiscal statement. There's no subsequent referral. I've discussed with LFO, and they said they don't need any subsequent referral on that. This bill was previously heard on May 7th, and it would require operators to enable public safety answering points to obtain street addresses and building names at a minimum from automatic location identification databases for 911 calls. There are some exemptions for the size of the particular structures involved, and it applies to multi-line telephone systems installed 1 year or more after passage.
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. Right, that was a critical piece that we obviously, in years past efforts, weren't able to get there because it didn't include that. But this is new construction, and so thank you for that. I would entertain a motion. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 598A as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 598A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk can call the roll, please.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fagan?
Excused.
Vice Chair Parrish?
Excused.
Chair Matthews?
Aye.
Thank you. The motion passes. And we'll need a carrier for Senate Bill 598A. Anybody wish to volunteer to carry the bill?
No, sir. Right.
Representative Witt?
Sure.
I'm getting the nod from Representative Witt. Great. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that very much. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 598A. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 33. Ms. Edwards, if you will.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 33 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It would add 13 agencies to and remove one from the list of those agencies required to designate individuals with authority to allocate resources to act as liaisons with the Office of Emergency Management.
Thank you very much. And Representative Reed is here. And if you would like to describe the Dash Ones prior to Representative Reed, it might be helpful for those not only on the committee but out there in the audience too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash One Amendment would create a 16-member task force on resilience plan implementation. The task force will be charged with developing an implementation plan in response to a Cascadia subduction zone event, specifically with regard to educating and training community leaders in emergency management and resiliency practices, as well as coordinating investments in equipment, facilities, and critical systems for enhanced resiliency and survivability.
Thank you very much. And Representative Tobias Reed, thanks for being here, and thanks for making this work for your schedule. We appreciate that. So,
thank
you. The drill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I want to start with at least three thank yous. First of all, thank you to all of you for accommodating me. I'm sitting down in the Ways and Means Committee, so my apologies for my schedule if it messed up yours. Second, I want to thank Representative Boone for your work on the resiliency plan, and more to say about that in a moment. And your committee administrator, Ms. Edwards, thank you for finding this bill that gives us a chance to do something that I think is really important. So back to Representative Boone. You all, I understand, have had some conversation and discussion about the resiliency plan. If your experience is anything like mine, it's a big, scary, thick document that lands with kind of a thud on a desk or a bookshelf, and is easy, for me at least, to be overwhelmed by it, to look at what's required, what the stakes are, and what we need to do. And I heard, I think it was about a climate change issue, someone said, do we have enough time? The answer came back, we have exactly enough time starting now. And I think that answer applies to the resiliency plan as well. So in trying to craft some way to react to the resiliency plan, to make progress on it, to not be overwhelmed by it, to not simply think there's too much, we can't do anything, that's where this amendment comes from, an effort to react to the resiliency plan, to craft some next steps, to be thoughtful about what we can afford and what we can do in the immediate future. I'm particularly interested in the education component and making sure that local governments and jurisdictions have a plan for themselves, people with the appropriate training and expertise, when these sorts of events do happen. Beyond that, it's the same sort of language that we're all familiar with in terms of gathering the appropriate talent and expertise to come back to the legislature with recommendations. And I would commend it to you. I hope we'll be able to add this to Senate Bill 33. I should also close by saying that we had conversations with Senator Boquist, who's aware of this amendment and okay with it, so yeah. I don't think we'll run into any trouble in the Senate if it gets that far. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Reed, for your kind words and for your due diligence in getting this out there ASAP.
Thank you.
This is really, really good news to me, and I'm really happy that you've just gone on doing this and you're going to do it this way. The one thing, I met with OSPAC today. They were meeting over at OEM, and the one thing that they would say is, you know, beyond liking it very much, and they said if they could, they support the amendment but recommend the time frame be longer or even make it permanent, like the Oregon Resilience Office as recommended in the plan. And because of the way the plan is designed to go through the years to be at the end of the plan to be where we want to be in 50 years, to have this end in just a couple of years didn't seem to make good sense. So that was their request, if we do consider it, and if you could consider that also. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I don't have any objection to that. I would say the language in here strikes me as sort of similar to an experience I've had on a totally different topic, where the initial task force, among the recommendations they made, was we should continue the work. There's too much here. So I could imagine a scenario where this amendment goes forward, the task force comes back and says among their recommendations is to make a task force permanent or at least longer lasting.
Thank you for that. Any other questions? And I appreciate your work. Thank you, and please extend my appreciation to Governor Ted Kulongoski, too, who has a very much interest in this. And I believe I'm with you when you can say that the document can be overwhelming. It's a very large document. It does make a thud. And in trying to prioritize just where should we start is a very difficult thing to do. And I know that the folks that are behind the study would like to say, just do it all, and it's really simple. But you have to really look at this thing in steps, and I think this is an appropriate step. So thank you very much for your testimony today, and thanks for your involvement in this and taking this on. Thank you, sir. And we will next bring up Marty Plotner, please, if you could. And it looks like General Caldwell would like to join you.
Yeah.
I think they're a package deal.
Some days.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department, and I didn't want Representative Reed to not have the opportunity to make sure that I extolled his hard work on this effort, and yours too, Mr. Chairman. I think the original bill, which we will have part of this, and the Dash 1 is really what we set out to do, and I'll let Marty talk to that, but I think this task force is a good idea, and I think it's timely, and I think that some of the things that we forecast that could possibly be out there, I mean, you don't want to say there's a boogeyman behind every bush, but in reality, we just don't know when this trigger is going to get pulled, and so anything we can do to further educate, and particularly, in my opinion, having been a local elected official, and on 10 years, county commissioner, city councilman, there was no manual that I got when I got elected that says, this is part of your job. Your job is to be ready and do things during an emergency. And no training, didn't know anything. I remember a seventh grade class one time, seventh grader went over to the junior high to talk to them. They wanted me over there for a government class, and this kid says, well, what do you got to do to be a county commissioner? And I thought to myself, I better not say it because it blow this kid, you know, a nice question. I said, but I'm thinking you got to have $50 and be able to sign an X. And that's the requirement, you know. And unfortunately, then when something goes wrong, we got to have folks that can execute. And without that training piece and without having some understanding of what your role is as an elected official, not only the players, which is the emergency managers you had in here today, like John and Dean, I mean, these folks, they do it, they study it, they're good at it. But they also got to have bosses that got a concept on what their responsibilities are. And I think this work group, looking at that resiliency plan, there's no way this legislature, any legislature in the next decade is going to be able to bite that whole elephant. So we need to take it a step at a time, and we need to do it, I think, in a thoughtful manner. And I think this group will help us put our arms around that whole situation and move us down the road in an orderly manner. So I just wanted to make that comment.
And thanks for your leadership on this, General Caldwell. Really appreciate your work.
Marty
Plotner.
Chairman Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marty Plotner, Director of the Office of Emergency Management for the Oregon Military Department. OSPEC has done some phenomenal work with this, and as been stated by both Representative Reed and General Caldwell, the work and the outreach piece on this, I think, is going to be the critical benchmark in the interim of trying to find funds and to take on the other daunting pieces of this resiliency plan. No amount of money in the world is going to save this, even if we threw the $2 billion at it today. ODOT says it'll take them 250 years just to correct the bridges alone, okay, money notwithstanding. So I think a lot of the components on this that become that overwhelming factor, this task force can actually pick up, break down, and actually separate outreach to the community, outreach to local officials, and the plan itself on what it takes with budget packages and those types of things that go with those components of it. So we are highly encouraged with this resiliency task force and strongly recommend its passing.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate that. And now I'll call up James Bela, is it, or Bela? I believe we might hear a difference of opinions now. And Bela. Please come forward, Mr. Bela. How are you today?
Okay.
Great. Thanks for being here.
Is there time rules? How much time do I have?
I won't put you on a time rule, but you know, if you can keep it fairly concise, and if you would please state your name for the record, you may begin.
I'm James Bela. I'm president of the founder of Oregon Earthquake Awareness since 1992. Vernonia and Tillamook certainly provide a lot of flood for thought, and I'm wondering how long a ham radio has before it spoils. If you're going to tell people the truth, be funny or they will kill you. Sherlock Holmes and Watson were on a camping trip lying on their backs and looking up at the stars. Sherlock Holmes says, Watson, look up at those stars and tell me what you think. And Watson said, I see billions of stars, and if some of those stars are suns like our sun, they may have galaxies, and there might be a planet like Earth in that galaxy, and if there is, there may be intelligent life out there. And Sherlock Holmes said, Watson, you idiot, someone has stolen our tent. Things are not always as they seem. My recommendation, let this bill, including the Dash 1 amendment, subduct and die in committee without a work session. The governor can always send a letter to the newly named agencies and categories and get names and commitments. Then they can practice together in a statewide planning exercise during the great shakeout drill. Military department always wants a linear path, but our Cascadia subduction zone is a horizontal problem. Not only is the fault horizontal, but the problem is horizontal. Fortunately, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we used when we created them. The problem is money. What was the question? It's telling to me that the Dash One Task Force has no funding. I'm a veteran, but I'm a veteran of state task forces of past years and former legislatures. Seismic Rehabilitation Task Force, the Landslide Task Force, all have suffered from Will Rogers and Everett Dirksen's effect. When a member moves from a state agency silo to an unfunded task force, it raises the IQ of both bodies. It is not only too early, but unwise, in my view, to buy into the suggested Oregon resiliency plan of 50 years, after many of us will, alas, be subducted ourselves. We don't have 50 years. 50 years was a motion, not in the enabling legislation, but instituted by OSPAC without benefit of any public hearing. This plan is a variation of Texas sharpshooting, where you shoot point blank at the barn, then draw targets around the bullet holes. Shoot first and declare whatever you hit was a target. It's a lot like my flight instructor's rubric for making an emergency landing. Try to hit the softest, cheapest thing as slowly as possible. The problem with doing nothing, of course, is that you never know when you're through. And it violates be prepared, get involved. There's wanting to do the right thing, doing the right thing, and looking like you're doing the right thing. Time is always right to do the right thing. Senate Bill 33 and 33-1 is not the right thing. Again, we're stuffing an innocuous housekeeping attempt to add more names. I urge you, let it die in committee and don't schedule a work session. And keep in mind, even if you're a minority of one, it is still the truth. And that itself is kind of funny. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Bila? Have you read the resiliency plan, sir?
I volunteered my time on the wastewater committee when I was in town.
Okay. I was just curious. The plan was commissioned, it was studied, and it brought forward quite a few recommendations. I'm just curious, would it be your position then that we should just wait and then the governor can just call this into place if we need to do that instead of planning ahead? Or what would be your take on this?
Are we talking about the Dash One amendments?
The Dash One amendment, sir, is what would address the resiliency plan and the task force moving forward to kind of put a strategy into action on how we're going to address the priorities of the state for disaster preparedness. I'm just curious.
Well, I forwarded some material that I sent to a previous committee, and in there is when I got into this in 1992, it was because I'm a geologist. I also have a master's in geotechnical engineering as well as a master's in geology. I wrote a document called Magnitude 911 Emergency, and under that guideline, I've given you some categorization for where to put the priorities. And to me, it's the ball got rolling in Oregon after the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, and the public walked the halls of the legislature and got a bill in to have a seismic safety commission. And if we had done one bridge a year, we would have done 24 bridges. And now we haven't really retrofitted a bridge other than phase one, which is to try to keep the connections from falling down. But it's this, I've been to all these task force and nothing has ever come of them, and it's not a, resiliency is an interrelationship. It's a working relationship. It's like the spokes in a bicycle wheel. And when these top-down things, you know, you're going to have a task force and it's going to train people. That happened after Hurricane Pam exercise. They did this planning exercise, but they didn't do the follow-up where people had the relationships going. I just don't see it going anywhere, and after being in this game for 24 years, it irritates the hell out of me that somehow we now need another 50 years because nobody's explained in the resiliency plan why nothing happened the last 24 years. But I said you should double ODOT's budget and get some of these bridges.
Okay. Thank you for that, sir. And thanks for your testimony today. I appreciate it. You have a nice day.
I'd like to add that I pulled Representative Boone out of the mud at the 2000 Penrose Conference with Brian Atwater.
Wonderful.
So I just like
sure she appreciates that.
Reminder.
Thank you, sir. And with that, is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 33? Sir? No? Ma'am? Thank you. Okay. Seeing nobody else here to testify on Senate Bill 33, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 33. Also, I failed to mention that the City of Portland did provide written testimony on behalf of the City of Portland on Senate Bill 598 as amended. It was favorable testimony, so I'm sure they'll be happy that we're moving the bill to the floor.
Since we're already out of committee and heading for the floor, we're pleased that they agree with
we
us.
We are. Yeah, we're just happy they're in favor. All right, well, with that, anybody else have anything for the good of the order? Nothing else? Thank you. And again, Ms. Edwards, thanks very much for coordinating today's panels. And with that, we will adjourn the committee.
No meeting Thursday, though.
There is no meeting on Thursday. And we will begin our resilience meetings in the month of June,
yes,
June 6th. And those will fall on Thursday. So
D-day.
We'll make sure we remind you of that again. And with that, if there's nothing else for the good of the order, we will adjourn the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you.